Welcome to Dialects for the week beginning Sunday, the 5th of December. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis.
Coming up this week, we get the latest Bristol Gaza Link convoy information. We have Sonnet Aboud in the studio with us. Then a welcome relief from some of the woes of the world, we enter the comedy fringe, a completely different topic. If you're all fed up with boring TV and radio comedy, we hear from the producer of one of Britain's most popular comedy podcasts in How to Do It Yourself. And we ask why more fringe comedians don't get mainstream exposure and look at one of Bristol's best fringe comedy clubs.
Anthea Page takes us on a trip to the Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique. We also have the first episode of A Chilling Ghost Story for Christmas, and those looking forward for more Nick Payne nomadic tales, he'll be back next week. Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol and can be found on BCFM 93.2, on Preston 103.2 on Preston FM, in St Albans on Radio Verulam, and on Unity FM in Birmingham 93.5. If you want to get involved, you can contact us through Volunteering Bristol, and details of that on the end of the show. And with me today is Sonnet Aboud from Bristol Gaza Link. Hi, Sonnet.
Hello, thank you very much for having me here.
No problem. And eagle-eared listeners will remember we've had Dr. Judith Brown from Bristol Gaza Link coming to talk about the Bristol Aid Convoy, which left on the 10th of the 10th of the 10th. Yeah. And I believe you have an update for us.
Yes, I do. Actually, it was a very eventful convoy. Had many, many problems. But the Road to Hope convoy left London on the 10th of October this year with 35 vehicles and thousands of pounds of aid, and it went through the UK, France, Spain, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia and Libya. And while we travelled through Libya, which was absolutely amazing, the people were incredibly hospitable. Once we got to the border, Egypt decided about 3 days after we arrived that no road convoy would actually go through that border post. So we were absolutely stranded. So I decided to come back. After I left, they decided to actually go by sea. And that meant that we had to raise $75,000 to take the vehicles across to El Arish. In 48 hours, we raised $75,000 via Facebook. It was an incredible effort from people all over the world. The ship was hired, and they proceeded to load the vehicles and the aid on board. What followed was almost unbelievable. The captain indicated that he did not receive any payment, started shouting, giving orders to his crew to pull up the anchor and leave the harbor. At this stage, we had 10 convoy members on board, one vehicle half loaded. The Libyan police officers were shouting and screaming and telling the captain to stop. At this stage, the captain actually pulled away from the harbor wall, broke the chains, broke the ropes, and departed for Greece, which was an absolute incredible turn of events because half the convoy was stranded on the Derna port with all the vehicles. One vehicle was on board and 10 of our convoy members.
So did the convoy actually make it to Gaza then?
Well, after they were dropped off, basically, in Greece, the convoy members that was on the ship was actually without their passports. So they had to fly back to the UK and then were told that they would not be allowed back into Turkey with their temporary passports. So our convoy was basically without management, sitting still in Derna. And from there, they were taken back to Libya. They stayed there for another 10 days in terrible conditions. They had almost no food, no water. Eventually, the Road to Hope managed to get to Gaza with 35 convoy members of the original 100 and not without many last-minute problems again. At this late stage, on Thursday night, the 25th of November, they actually entered the gates of Gaza. The aid was distributed. We took some medicines, toys, clothes, sport equipment, stationery, books, and that sort of thing for the people. And that all went to churches and hospitals.
Now, obviously, this aid is massively needed in Gaza. Can you tell us why?
Well, the economy has been devastated by the blockade. No goods are allowed out, and incoming aid is severely restricted. What most people do not know is that items like cement and supplies necessary for rebuilding the homes and hospitals and schools are not allowed in. People have to rely on rubble, basically, to rebuild their homes. There are no stationery available for children in schools. For example, they use paper seven times over. So it is absolutely vital that we help these people to break this siege and this blockade. And we will definitely try and go on another convoy through Bristol-Gaza Link and help them.
If someone wants to get involved with Bristol-Gaza Link, how can they get in contact with you?
They can just Google Bristol-Gaza Link and all the information is on.
Now time for a tune. This is Animal Trap featuring Lodos and the tune is called Blue War.
Because right now, man, I'm doing what suits you. Wicked man, pollute you. Politicians' positions are always changing like the Karma Sutra. I know where I'm going because my path is set in stone. But I gotta keep on time, like I mentioned. No, people wanna use me like I'm a stepping stone. But I set the tone when I search deep inside. I can never hide like a faded memory is close by my side. Snakes and vultures, they're begging me, telling me lies. See them just feeding off my energy with my psychedelic chemistry. My words are my weaponry. I'm leaving the legacy. Fake man befriending me. Yeah, I gotta watch these frenemies, but to me, these waste man are faded memories. Memories. Paradox praising Jehovah, listening to Hover. What about them kids soldiers? Fighting gets hot, emotionally they colder. They just doing what their elders have done. We don't need to fight for water, drinking is fun. Spiritually suppressed, so they picking up guns. Oppressed, so they fight, but weak man would run. Thoughts coming to me like nightmares. Daily searching through the rubbish, wondering who might care. Don't watch, who might stare. Searching for the truth, rude boy, when it's right there. People are starving, but you're flashing your nightcares. Blatantly manufactured by child slavery. Economically, that favors you and me, but I can never let them be a faded memory. He tried but she never woke up. But he can't feel choked up. He wanted to wet a man till he got soaked up. Yeah, it's an endless cycle. Stuck in between the Quran and the Bible. Trying to stay straight, didn't care about a title. His life was kind of spiteful. Drinking drugs was vital just to calm the pain. Reconditioning his brain just to raise the shame. His mother blowing in the wind and he feels the blame. Living in the sin he can't turn away. Struggle life brings, now addicted to cane. His life was turning grey and the elders say he was throwing it away. Yeah, he went astray, lost all his energy. But how can you and me ever let him be a faded memory, memory?
That was Animal Trap featuring Lodose. If you wish to find out more about this Bristol artist who's still looking for a record deal at the moment, then you can check him out on youngerminds.co.uk. Next time you're listening to or watching comedy on TV or radio and groaning at the bad jokes, there may be hope after all. I'm joined now by Julius Abraham, Bristol impresario who's behind something called The Jam, not the band, at Day and Night Bar in St Nicholas Street, at the back of the market in Bristol City Centre. Hi Julius, welcome to Dialect.
How you doing?
Tell me about your involvement in comedy. How long have you been involved in comedy generally?
I've been involved in comedy about 7 years, and I came to Bristol, I was at uni, and I'm an electronic engineer, and I did that for a little while, and the people that do engineering and electronics, really interesting people, but when the only joke that you hear every day is something like pi over 4 equals z, and everyone's laughing, I thought I got to get out of here.
So, well, there might be over. Yeah, okay. Robert Axton used to study electrical engineering.
Yeah,
so,
indeed,
there might be.
It's funny, Harry Hill, he used to be a doctor.
Yeah.
So it's weird, the professions people come from, and then where they come from to do comedy.
Okay, so when did you start thinking about starting your own club?
It was after I did Jesters. I did some sketches for BBC Three. If you type my name into YouTube, Julius Abraham, you can see the sketches I've done for BBC, ITV2. And then I just thought, I need to keep practising, because you can write really good stuff, but if you don't try it out on a crowd, it might not work.
You only think it might be funny in your head.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So what did you do? How were you involved at Jesters?
Basically, I just bowled in there. I want to do comedy. He was like, "Who are you?" I goes, "I'm no one. I want to do comedy." He goes, "Well, have you been practicing?" I said, "No." "Well, yeah, in the mirror. I want to do comedy." He goes, "Right, I'll give you a trial." I did a trial, and it went all right.
Okay, well, you're doing better than Justin Lee Collins. He said he'd tried to do comedy for 10 years and failed all the time, and he's become very successful.
Yeah, he has. I was at the competition where he got noticed. They were looking for a new talent comic, and there were 20 of us, and he was the compere.
Right.
And he came out, and he was swearing a lot, but it was really funny, just swearing at people, but he made it in a really, really funny way.
Okay.
And the BBC were like, "Well, we don't want any of you, we want Justin Lee Collins." And he wasn't even in the competition.
Do you think sometimes, like, swearing is just makes them look avant-garde and a bit modern and daring, so they think, yeah, go on and we'll have that?
Yeah, if someone's just swearing for swearing's sake, it is a little bit too much, but, yeah.
So were you involved, that's the Jesters that was on Stokes Croft?
Yeah, when it was small, and now it's big.
No, it's big. What do you think of big comedy clubs generally? I mean, there's good points there, but it can be a little bit like, you know, sort of like a factory conveyor belt.
It is.
On, 5 minutes off.
Yeah, yeah, you're dead right. It used to be like little clubs, backroom places. You used to get a smoke in there.
Yeah.
You had that atmosphere, but that's all gone now. And so is the smell of farts as well. So I'm kind of, well, no, the smell of farts has got worse now that people can't smoke. Why are we talking about farts? How did we get here?
Well, you started. So what sort of comedy generation do you sort of tend to identify yourself with? Because those people who, like, well, there's the real old school pre-David Baddiel, who, you know, it's a sort of this background thing, it's really underground, and then there's sort of like the people who come on and talk about football and their girlfriends, and it's like all that sort of thing. I mean, what sort of comedy do you like to do?
I like to keep it current, but I also do just stuff that interests me.
You run an alternative comedy club on Stokes Croft. How did that run?
Yeah, that's tonight, Tuesdays. It's every Tuesday, Stokes Croft, the Bank. It used to be called Mackie's, but before that it was called the Bank, and now it's the Bank again, and I'm there every Tuesday, and starts 9 o'clock.
Oh, brilliant, okay.
Yeah, it's free as well, and so is my Thursday gig.
What are your influences then? What are your favourite sort of comics that are around at the moment?
I love Lee Mack, Alan Carr, Jimmy Carr, he's grown on me, and 8 out of 10 Cats, is it? Yeah,
yeah.
On Channel 4. And I also like How Not to Live Your Life on BBC Three. That is so funny, Dan Clark.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. Probably quite a wide question, but what for you makes a good comedian? You know, what are you thinking about?
What do I think makes a good comedian?
Yeah.
If I knew that, I wouldn't be here. What makes a good comedian? Someone misdirection, spontaneous, long hair, beard. You're there. mate.
Result. What do you think of the state of TV comedy? Obviously, it's been some years since Fawlty Towers. Now we've got stuff like the IT Crowd and whatnot. Do you think TV comedy's
alright?
Yeah,
I love IT Crowd. Do you like it? It's silly humour, isn't it?
Yeah, I
think it's okay. What else do I like on TV? I can't think. But How Not to Live Your Life is one of my favourites. Okay.
Tell us about the jam. Tell us about your night.
Thursday, day and night. It's a free comedy event. Starts at 9 p.m. It's St Nicholas Street, just behind St Nicholas Market.
Yeah.
And I have new comics, and we all just go for it. And, some zany stuff comes out.
Okay, so it's got a bar so we can all sit and get drunk?
Yes. Okay. Reasonably priced drinks.
Okay. It says on the label BYO Food. Does that mean we can bring our sarnies and keep ourselves, keep our stomachs entertained as well?
Yeah, BYO. Good. Yeah, bring your own food.
Brilliant. Okay. So, any interest in that, email thejam@live.co.uk. Presumably, if you're a comic interested in sort of joining in or whatever, you can email that.
Yep.
Or call 0781 215 581.
Yeah, that's my phone number. I don't like the way you said that. You know when someone reads your number out and you're like, is that my number? 078 121 555 81.
Got it. Okay, thank you very much.
All right.
Julie Sayham, thank you very much for coming on, and best of luck with your night.
All right, thank you. Cheers.
Well, one person who's been biting the bullet on comedy for several years now is Richard Cray. He lives in London and most weeks produces a comic podcast with some friends in his spare time. Before we hear one of Richard's shows, or an edit of one at least, Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to him about what he does and how he does it.
If you're at university, or if you're thinking of going to university, and you're thinking of taking a media studies degree, thinking it will be a quick way into the media, you're wrong. I think it's a lot better to do a subject at university that will help you specialise along with whatever skill that you have. I don't even think that it's necessary to go to university. The only reason why I think things have changed now is because there are so many different little niche courses that you can take. I just wouldn't necessarily recommend doing one in media studies. I think getting involved with a university radio station, absolutely. There's a lot of people are coming out of that effectively is doing what we were doing at Radio Thamesmead in the late 80s. I think that's the nearest example I can think of. Do internships if you can at a local BBC station or a community station. You'll meet people, and that's half the job is just meeting people and keeping your ear to the ground. And if you,
so it's who you know, what not what you know.
If you are somebody that has a particular skill, you probably will be thought of, and you will register with those people. You know, it can be because you've got a particular skill or a particular knowledge. There's more people taking media studies courses now than ever before. And what happens is they graduate at 21, 22, they come out, and, I mean, if you take a look through media and arts jobs now, aimed at people who've graduated from, they the most appalling, I mean, runner's jobs now. If you want a runner's job in a Soho production house, you'll be lucky if you get £12,000. And the reason why these studios are paying £12,000 to runners to work 16, 18-hour days, you know, and basically be the person that everybody puts their foot on, is because they know they could ask you to saw your arm off, and they will still get applications from people. You're going to be fighting with people like that if you come out of university with a media studies degree. Better to come out with a degree of something else and a range of experience, maybe working for two or three, you know, a university station, yes, if you're interested in presentation or production or editing, but also doing internships at a BBC or an ILR or a community station, whatever is, you know, within your personal budget and circumstances, you know, whatever works best for you. Everyone is different. And everybody wants to do something different, which is the joy of the media, is that it has this wide remit. And there are so many little areas where people can slot themselves in. But I tell you what, if I had all the answers, if you had all the, we'd be very rich. We'd have our own island, you know, by now. I mean, you know, the thing is, we don't know all the answers. And I'm, you know, on the fringe of the fringe comedy circuit, doing a podcast at the moment, 404 Funny. It's very good. We're on iTunes, just type it into the search bar, it'll come up. I like doing podcasting because it's not like doing radio. You know, there's a lot more flexibility in terms of language and time and subject matter and stuff like that. You're more likely to get picked up from doing a podcast these days than from doing a media studies course. It's
what kind of equipment do you need to get started with doing podcasting then?
There are loads of books on the subject, and a lot of them are very good. Personally, I mean, all I can say is I can tell people what I use, and I use an Edirol R09 hard disk recorder. It's about £240. I use Adobe Audition, which is a fantastic piece of audio software. Not as cheap as it used to be. It's about £300, I think, the current version of that. I remember speaking to somebody at Channel 4 a couple of years ago, and they said to me, the thing that people should be spending the most money on is their microphone. And actually, you can get a very decent professional sounding microphone for about £180 now, a Rode. Rode are an Australian manufacturer, and they do very good microphones. Or, failing that, Shure SM57s. Industry standard, about £70 plus £10 for a cable. Get a pop shield. If you're in an environment where there's a lot of reverberation, consider getting what they call a reflection filter, or investing in some sort of acoustic treatment for wherever you're recording. Take out a subscription to Sound on Sound magazine. That's where you see the new products. It's got some great tips in there. It's written by industry professionals. It'll cost you about £50 a year. And it also has a good second-hand section at the back where you might be able to pick up a bargain or two. It is possible, really, to set up your own little studio. I mean, mixers are, you know, 10 a penny now, really. Behringer do a great line, which have inbuilt FX even. And even the smaller things, if you've got an iMac, even GarageBand or GarageBand. Well, I can never remember which pronunciation it is. But nevertheless, I've heard some great podcasts done purely on the internal software on an Apple Mac. So, and Audacity is a very cheap piece of software that people use a lot. It's a case of, you know, if you have this, it will soon become evident to you, if you've never edited audio in your entire life, it will soon become evident to you whether you're any good at it or not, using these things. I guarantee you, if you use Adobe Audition every night for 3 months, if at the end of it you haven't got something whereby you're actually proud to play it to somebody, then give up.
Okay, that's all the hardware. What about the content?
Well, you can't teach that. But there are courses. There are some fan. I mean, comedically speaking, there are some very good courses around. People that I used to be involved in podcasting with who run Comedy 365, they do Pepperstock courses. I think they've still got some of those running. So if you search for Pepperstock courses, comedy courses, something will come up. There's a guy called Mark Blake, who's a comedy professional who I think still does sort of one-to-one tuition, but also runs a course, a full-time course, I think, at Thames Valley University here in London or on the outskirts of London. Mark's biggest claim to fame, I think, is that when Catherine Tate was looking to get out of straight acting and into comedy, she signed up for his course. And I think as a almost direct result of that course, what she learnt on that course, she obviously took it away with the skills that she already had, but that's one of the reasons why she became so big so quickly in comedy. But essentially, listen to as much as you possibly can, see what's out there already, see what the benchmark is, and wonder how you can do something that's different but yet will still sit alongside those other pieces.
Would you agree, though, that actually listening to quite a lot of comedy on network radio now is almost an impetus in itself to do stuff, because people think
it's
to themselves,
so bad. Yeah, you think this is so bad that I can do it myself, and that's exactly the right attitude to have. It's almost punk rock in a way. You know, it was like, God, you know, well, you know, I'm talking about punk rock, and I'm wearing a T-shirt, ladies and gentlemen, underneath my checkered shirt, which says "Enjoy Prog Rock." You know, I'm 41 and I have moobs. You know, I'm a fine one to be talking about punk rock. But genuinely, I think that actually, if you speak to comedians on the circuit, it will be, I got fed up with this, or I got fed up with hearing that, and I thought I'd have a go myself. And there are some comedians who've actually made a very good career. And that was their catalyst, was just, I hate everything that's out there. I'm going to go out there and do what I think is funny. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it's a disaster. I personally, being somebody who doesn't do live performance of comedy, but I've teched many shows, and I've co-produced a show on the London Fringe, and I've taken shows to Edinburgh, and I've been involved in comedy podcasting now for nearly 6 years. I like looking at it from a different angle, and I touched on this earlier, and I like to look at acts and say, you know, you should try doing stuff in audio only, or little, you know, little bites on little video bites or whatever, because there is this general thing is that you slog away on the circuit, you blow 10 grand a year on an Edinburgh show for 3 years, then you come back and you might get a writing gig. I just don't see the point in that. It's a lot of money lost. Edinburgh is a real wrecker of friendships. You know, you make a lot of friends, but you lose a lot of your closest friends. I do agree that there's a lot of dross, and as I said, you know, the BBC is the only organisation making this sort of stuff. They nearly had competition a couple of years ago from Channel 4. It was the 4 Digital Radio Consortium, which would have included Channel 4 Radio and E4 Radio, which was going to have a very large comedy section, and was actually going to go out and try and kick Radio 4 and BBC 7's butt. And unfortunately, because Channel 4 itself was so short of money, it rather wisely decided that it would pull the plug on the stations before it, you know, started broadcasting. For the sake of Channel 4, that was a very good decision to make. The downside of that was that the BBC started to think, hey, we can do whatever we want now because we're not going to have any competition. And essentially what it seems to me that they've been doing in the 2 years since then is effectively just trawling around the usual Oxford and Cambridge circuits. I'm not dissing Oxford, the Oxbridge circuit in any way, but there's more out there. And it annoys me when I hear a radio show and I hear the same voices and, you know, the same writers and stuff like that. It gets on my nerves. There's much more out there.
So what about your site? Tell us what's driving that.
£24 hosting a month. It's called 404 Funny. We've been going. It's our first birthday on October 1st. Most of the stuff we've had on there for the last year has been stuff that I'd done with other people for a very successful podcast called Comedy 365, which is still going. We split about this time last year. I went my way and took a lot of my stuff with me, whereas Sowerby and Luff, who started Comedy 365, now treat that basically as their own sort of testing pad for new ideas and their already established show, which has had 10 million downloads. My own shows, I do a show called The 404 Special, which is a bit like Dr. Demento, but it's using PodSafe music tracks, which basically means that people have allowed their music to be played on podcasts without expecting any performance royalties. I do a show called Lion News, which came out of an online newspaper that was that myself and Brian Luff, who runs Comedy 365, did in 2004-2005, and I sort of took the rights, if you like, with me to do that. It's basically new satire, but the fact that we're calling it Liar News and that it's a podcast, so you have to start it from the beginning of the show where there is a disclaimer, means that you can actually get away with quite a lot more than you could if you were doing it on a BBC station. We syndicate a few programmes. We've syndicated some stuff from a sketch troupe called Pega Bovine, who are currently on hiatus. There's an American comic, brilliant absurdist American comic called Will Franken. I think he was described as San Francisco's best legal alternative to drugs. Not to everybody's taste, but I think he's pretty special. Close to home, we have people like John Dredge, who has been involved with Resonance FM for a number of years, does little short things, sort of fake lectures. Lots of other people are sort of involved, but it's very difficult. You know, you're asking people to do things. They're not getting any money for doing them. They're doing it at the goodness of their heart. Some of these people have got agents and stuff, and the agents are saying, well, do you think you maybe want to hold back on that and see if we can take that somewhere? It's, you know, it's an extra way of getting yourself known and getting your name cropping up on search engines and stuff like that. That's the way that I see it. It's... You know, the world is your oyster. Why sit around waiting for a 6-show contract to do a late night show on Radio 4, which can only be heard in Britain, when you can do exactly the same thing to your own standards and rules and your own production schedule, and you can have it heard by the world. I mean, you know, the world literally is your oyster now. That's the beauty of the internet. And yes, there's a lot of dross out there, but the great thing about having so much dross out there is that when something that's really good comes along, it can immediately be noticed by people of taste, obviously. I think a lot of people know a good thing when they see or hear it.
Thank you very much to Richard Cray there, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling.
Our next feature is by Dialect's intrepid reporter Anthea Page, who has recently returned from a trip travelling around central and northern Mozambique. This interview took place at Gorongosa National Park, which was ravaged during the 16-year-long civil war, and most of the animals there were slaughtered by starving Mozambicans. The interview is with Greg Seacar, who is an American entrepreneur and philanthropist. He, with Scott Jones, founded Boston Technology, one of the earliest firms to sell voicemail systems to telephone companies. Since then, Greg has resigned from his for-profit boards and dedicated himself to humanitarian activities. He is now working with the government of Mozambique to restore the famous national park at Gorongosa and has pledged $40 million over the next 30 years to rebuild the park as a source of tourist income for the local population. Here he talks to Anthea Page from the Gorongosa Park about his plans for restoration.
I'm in
Chitengo, Gorongosa.
And I'm with Greg Carr, who has virtually restored the park to its former glory. So hello, Greg.
It's nice to be here and with you in the jungle.
Can you tell us how it all began?
Well, this Gorongosa National Park was for many decades considered people's favorite national park in Africa because it has the most beautiful ecosystems, the diversity of wildlife. In the 1960s, tourists would come a lot from the UK and visit this park, have the vacation of their life. But then the park suffered for 30 years through two different civil conflicts in this country. But especially at the end of the second civil conflict in the 90s, there was a lot of commercial poaching and they extirpated most of the large animals. When I came here for the first time in 2004, I saw very few animals. And I went to the governor of Mozambique. And I said, let's work together and restore your magnificent national treasure, Gorongosa National Park. And they said, let's do it. And the Mozambican government are wonderful, visionary people who love their land. So we have, for the last 5 years, worked to restore animal populations, to rebuild beautiful tourism structures. We're sitting here looking at a nice restaurant, and to improve roads. And, you know, nature is so resilient that this park is now flourishing once again with wildlife. There's one more piece to this project I want to mention, which is not just protecting and restoring nature. It's helping the human beings who live next to this park. Because Gorongosa National Park creates a lot of jobs. Good jobs. Jobs in tourism, jobs in science, jobs in forestry. We employ 60 forester people hired and trained locally to restore some parts of Mount Gorongosa. So a national park can be good for nature and good for humans.
And this has almost become like a mission for you, hasn't it?
Well, I would say for us. In other words, we're a team. There's a lot of us here doing this. I'm just one person on a team, and 98% of the people who work here are Mozambicans. And really, they're the ones who are working to restore their national treasure, and they're the ones that are engaged in every one of the different activities. Our veterinarian is Mozambican. Are the people that work in the communities are Mozambican. The people that I know drove you today on a safari are Mozambican. So it's really, for me, this story is exciting, not because there's an American here. This story is exciting because Mozambicans love their own country, and they're the ones making this succeed.
When did you go to the Mozambican government? What year was that?
It was in 2004, but in the beginning, of course, it's all about introductions and who are you and just developing a plan together. So we spent about 3 years mostly planning, talking, and engaged in very small projects. And then finally, at the end of 2007, we signed a contract with the government of Mozambique to jointly manage this park. It's a very important point that this is a public-private partnership. It wasn't as if the Mozambicans handed this off to some international people, not by any means. This is a partnership, and we together made the plan, and we're together implementing the plan.
Do they come and visit it quite often?
Oh, absolutely. It's a constant set of people coming through here from the government of Mozambique. They might be local officials. I mean, yesterday I was with two local chiefs of the communities across the river. But it might be district or provincial officials or people from the capital city, Maputo, and from different ministries. Maybe the Ministry of Agriculture, maybe the Ministry of Health, or the Ministry of Education. Because our project is multidisciplinary, and we're engaging in all of those activities.
So do locals worry a bit about the lions coming back? Because there is a fear there, isn't there, attacking people in their local villages?
Yes, and not just lions, elephants or crocodiles. In this national park or in any national park in Africa, one has to be concerned about human-animal conflict. The people who live next door to Gorongosa are some of the most resource-constrained populations in the world. They don't have a lot. At least they don't have a lot in material things. They have a beautiful culture. But if they grow a small farm and work really hard on 3 hectares, and then in a single night, elephants could walk across the river and eat their entire farm. So we have worked for the last 5 years to prevent that from happening. And this year is the first year that not a single family lost their farm to elephants. And that's because of a variety of activities that our rangers engaged in, basically to scare the elephants back over the river on their own side, because there is plenty to eat inside the park. It's just a little tempting for them to go over and eat somebody's pumpkin patch.
Local people, they're very good at handicrafts.
Craft in some cases, and also other kinds of useful products. For example, just this morning at breakfast, I had a coffee with a woman who is helping a local community to make their own soap. And other shampoo and lotions and so forth that they will sell to us, to tourists. And she's helping that community to create that as their own business that they own. And so we think that the national park can create a lot of small businesses around its periphery. We now buy our vegetables for our restaurant from across the river. Of course we do, from a local community. So it's not just whether or not someone got a job inside the park. It is also the economic activity that the park sends out into the neighboring communities.
Do you see this park becoming like a big international park, like Kruger? Or are you going to keep it fairly low-key, or will you have to go international at some point?
No, that's such a good question and an important question. A national park, any national park, belongs to the people of that country. It's an institution created by the democratic will of a nation that says we want to set aside a beautiful part of our land for all of us to enjoy. So it's not a private reserve of some wealthy person or something like that. A national park, I think, is a glorious concept. It's a very democratic concept. Where we're sitting now in the main camp of this national park called Chitengo, you can come here for almost nothing. If you bring your own tent and you bring your own food and cook out, it costs you very little to come here. And that's how it should be, forever. Now, there might be other parts of this park where somebody builds a fancy lodge and charges a lot of money. Well, that's a choice. And the reason that's good for the national park is that it takes money to run a national park. So if you can make some money from the tourism industry in one part of the park, you can use that money to subsidize another part of the park for everybody.
That was Anthea Page from Gorongosa National Park there, talking to Greg Carr about his restoration project for the park, and you can hear part 2 in next week's show.
In the run-up to Christmas this year, we have a three-part ghost story. It's by one of Britain's greatest thriller writers, Dennis Wheatley, set in an isolated public school towards the end of the Second World War. It's the diary of a wounded and recuperating pilot, Toby Jugg, spelt with two G's, who finds himself preyed upon by supernatural forces and the people who are supposed to be looking after him.
Saturday the 9th of May. Still no sign of Junior. It really is extraordinary. Even if she were ill, I feel sure that on receiving my last letter she would send me some kind of message. I wrote to her again in the hope that if my earlier letter is still chasing her around the country, this last one will catch her on her return to Queensclere. In it I did not mince matters, but spill the whole story. I had an untroubled night again, the fourth in succession. It looks as if the thing's activity is in some way dependent on the moon being either at or near full. During the dark quarter, there is naturally no moonlight to throw the shadow, and I've never seen it while the moon was in her first or third quarters. Am I experiencing some psychic phenomenon, I wonder? It might not be the first time. I remember something from my school days. It happened soon after the beginning of the first summer term that I spent in the senior house in Wayland's. That was in 1937, so I was very nearly 16 at the time. Wayland's is in Cumberland, and the school takes its name from the ruins of the ancient abbey that stands nearly at the centre of its vast private park. There were no classes or teaching in the accepted sense, but a large part of each day was given to study hours. In the recreation hours, there were no organized games, as that would have entailed captains of side and obedience to them. Instead, there was tennis, golf, swimming, squash, and other sports for those who liked them, and for those who didn't, who could go for a walk or laze about or even go to bed if they preferred to do so. Naturally, there are no exams or end-of-term reports at Wayland's, as the theory was that we were there to develop our individualities and not our brains. I don't think I've mentioned, by the way, that Helmut was the German master at Wayland's. He's not, of course, a German himself, but a Czech. And his full name is Dr. Helmut Lisicki. I must explain now how it was that Uncle Paul and Julia happened to be in the vicinity on the night I was scared out of my wits by some psychic phenomenon. The school is situated in one of the most desolate parts of Cumberland. It's lovely country, but there isn't a hotel or even a comfortable inn within 20 miles. When the school first started, that made it awkward for parents who wanted to come down in term time to see their children. In consequence, the school authorities built a sort of bungalow village at the southern end of the park. It consists of about a dozen comfortable cottages having 4 to 6 rooms apiece and a clubhouse with rooms at the back for visiting chauffeurs and a permanent staff. Parents can write to the bursar and book one of the cottages for a night or two if they wish, and meals are provided for them in the clubhouse during their stay. Uncle Paul and Julia had arranged to come down for a couple of nights right at the beginning of the summer term, because I'd not seen them for some months owing to their having been abroad. It was not until I was just about to go to bed that I suddenly had the bright idea of paying them a surprise visit. But I didn't hurry myself about setting out, as I thought that after dinner they would probably remain in the clubhouse talking to some of the other visitors till about 10:30. So it was getting on for that when I put on my mac and let myself out of the school by one of its side doors. I must have covered nearly 1/4 mile and had the abbey on my immediate right when I happened to glance in that direction. I suddenly saw the glow of a misty reddish light in the middle of the ruins. I was not so much surprised as intrigued, because it was common knowledge at Wayland's that soon after the place was started, the school authorities had converted the crypt of the old abbey into a Masonic temple. It was the one and only place that was out of bounds to us, and none of the masters would ever tell us anything about it, with the result that there was quite a lot of casual speculation as to what it was like inside and what went on there. All I had been able to gather from some of the older chaps was that it had no connection with British masonry, but was a lodge of the Grand Orient, as continental masonry is called, and that fellowship of it gave one lots of pull in political and financial worlds. The masters were all believed to be fellows, and pupils who'd proved satisfactory were given a special course during the last term to prepare them for initiation before they left. No doubt I should have been initiated myself in due course if I hadn't run away from Wayland's to join the RAF, but, well, that's another story. In view of all this, the sight of the red glow in the middle of the ruins naturally aroused my curiosity. In order to get a better view, I altered my course a little until I came opposite a big gap in the ruin and could see through a broken archway into the body of the church. The ground there was very rough, being broken by grassy mounds, and here and there old gravestones half buried in the coarse grass. Some 30 feet away I saw an old box-like stone tomb, considerably bigger than most of the others, and I hurriedly made in that direction with the idea of crouching down behind it. Suddenly, without rhyme or reason, I had the feeling that somebody was standing just behind me. In a flash, I swiveled round. With a gasp of relief, I realized that I'd been mistaken. There was nobody there, not a thing. Inclined to laugh at the fright I'd given myself, I knelt down to do up my shoe. I'd hardly twisted the ends into the bow before the same horrid feeling assailed me. I could have sworn that someone was overlooking me from behind, that a pair of eyes were boring right through my back. My eyes were starting from their sockets. The palms of my hands were damp, and I could feel my heart pounding against my ribs. It was suddenly borne in upon me that not for all the money in the world would I turn round again from fear now of what I might see there. I knew, with a certainty that brooks no argument, that in another second it would be too late to escape. Something outside all human experience, something beyond belief, unholy, loathsome, terrifying, was in the very act of launching itself upon me where I knelt. My will broke. I sprang to my feet and fled. Yet I never forgot the feeling that contact with unseen evil gave me. And my reason for describing my experience at Wayland's is to make it quite clear that I cannot be mistaken now. In spite of the passing of the years, I recognize it again instantly that first night, just 6 weeks ago, when I woke to find the full moon streaming in under the curtain and saw upon the band of light that abominable, undulating shadow. I'm not suffering from nightmares, and I'm not going mad.
That was an extract there from The Haunting of Toby Jug, written by Dennis Wheatley. Part two coming up next week. Well, splendid. Time for Mr. Boombastic himself, Mr. Tim Burrows here, resident poet. I'm not wearing a pork pie hat today. What's going on?
It's a bit cold.
Too cold to wear a pork pie hat.
Too cold, yes.
It's rough times in the world of poetry. Well, alluding to our earlier interview with Solit Aboud, we have a Palestinian theme with our poetry this week, I understand.
Yes, this is a poem I wrote about Palestine, and I'd like to dedicate it to friend Saeed, who went on one of the aid convoys recently. It's called In Death Valley. Ruled by the Bible and the gun, ruled by the Quran and the bomb, divided by walls and cultural chasms, driven by hate and inequality, dying the same in pale equality, dying the same in gory equality. Widows and fatherless children, flowers and photographs in cemeteries, trees line the avenues of death, wails of mourning drown the bird song at dawn. A low lament covers the songs of joy, a stone replaces the child's toy. No sun in the sky this day, whirring helicopters of death fill the sky, bringing swift death by missile, a savage bolt from on high. Palestine, the angel of death hovers above you, spitting death, preaching separation, crying tears, delivering desolation. Your sons and daughters and those of Israel dwell in the valley of the skull, dying both oppressed by division, growing the bitter fruit of enmity, turning words of spirit into the poison of hatred. But a widow, her cheeks lined with dust and tears, her heart full of sorrow and fears, carries a small olive tree to the wall, a symbol of lost orchards buried beneath, yet also a prayer of hope, ripe fruit for future generations.
Thank you very much. On a slightly different note, I understand you have a very brief poem for your mum.
Yes, but
rather
my mum,
poorly.
Yeah, my mum's ill at the moment, so this was for you, mum, and we all wish you'd get well soon. It's I was reading a load of old Zen poets today and kind of got something from them, so this came out from that. Sometimes I like to feel light, like I am no one, in a place that no one knows, where the cares of the world cannot rest their load, where my mind can rest easy in the stillness of meditation, still as a mountain.
Tim Burrows, thank you very much.
Thanks.
And more from you in future weeks. Well, without further ado, let's find out what's going on this week. Hello, Jess Sparks.
Hello, John. This is a What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 10th of December, the punk covers group No More Heroes will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Also on 10th of December, 34 Years in Counting for the Vibrators will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and recently it was St Andrew's Day. And in honour of this, I present Red Hot Chili Pipers. This is from the album Blast Live, and it's a track titled Highland Cathedral. That was Red Hot Chili Pipers with Highland Cathedral from the album Blast Live. For more information, you can check out www.redhotchilipipers.com. Moving into Saturday, 11th of December, Flash Harry will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Finally, on Sunday, 12th of December, Skin will be performing with support from Toby Jepson and also Matty Alfonzetti at the Thecla in the Grove, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. Well, in light of some of the recent student protests, you might be interested to know that the French Aid campus is the scene of an occupation at the moment by students, and they're always welcome to receive visitors who want to chat to them about it. French Aid campus, that's in Cold Harbour Lane, and have occupied a cafeteria there called Core 24, C-O-R-E-2-4, Core 24. They're always welcome to receive visitors who are sort of supporting them, or perhaps if you disagree with them, perhaps you care to chat to them about that as well. But they're up there on the French Aid campus, Cold Harbour Lane, and you can go and visit the cafeteria and see the student occupation. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 12 noon every Sunday. We're also broadcast on Preston FM and in St Albans on Radio Rulham. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for this or download your weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk.
You can also find a lo-fi mono version of Dialect for dial-up connections at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning. Thank you to our studio guests today, Sonnet Aboud and Julius Abraham. Reporters this week were Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Studio production this week was by Michael Noyce. The producer was Tony Gosling.
Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You can also look at them up on the web, bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis.
Wishing you a very good week. Next week, it will be the Islamic New Year, no less. From all the team in our Queen Square studio in Bristol City Centre, thank you for listening. So until the same time next week, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Just look in the mirror, wrecking the liver, blood running like rivers, like an Irish quiver singing.